I think it's a wonderful practice that you have to have a Q&A or a time of discussion after the morning service, but I asked Pastor Scott if I could have this session to talk instead, and I appreciate your patience with me, because every element of that story is essential: creation, fall, and redemption, and I just wasn't smart enough to package three elements into two sessions. I have to keep them separate in my mind. So now we're going to talk about the fall. We need to talk about how the fall of mankind affects everyone and everything. Turn in your Bibles, please, then, to Genesis chapter 3. We're going to first talk about the fall of Adam and Eve and its effects on everyone before we then turn to talk about its effects on everything. While you turn, I'm grateful to have the 5th and 6th grade class here. They heard me talk about Fruity Pebbles and decided they would probably stay for the next session. You're very welcome to be here. I do love cereal. One of our best friends, we just had a birthday party for me, which we don't do very often, you know, but I'm 42, and that was just a little over a week ago. We had some friends over, and some of our best friends, what did they get me for my birthday, which is totally unexpected? They got me two boxes of cereal. This is why Fruity Pebbles came up as a sermon illustration. So, you probably have lots of do's and don'ts to keep track of as a citizen of Canada, as a student in your school or home school, and as a child in your family. But Adam and Eve's do list was fairly short. Fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over it. Start by working and keeping the garden. That's the creation mandate, I've called it. I've also called it the cultural mandate because it ultimately produces human cultures. And yet inside that to-do list, which is fairly simple and short, is a nearly infinite number of possibilities. Adam and Eve could do pretty much whatever they wished because their wishes were aligned with God's wishes. But Adam and Eve's don't list, by contrast, was just one item long. Actually, look back at Genesis 2:17. Of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. The perfect man and woman with perfect loves, perfect bodies, and perfect minds were very unlikely to disobey their one don't, I would presume. But for reasons we cannot fully know, because God has not revealed them, God allowed a malevolent, evil force to enter his very good creation. And as that serpent approached Eve with the first temptation in the history of our planet, not the last, he knew he had to overcome God's threat that Eve would die. So his chosen strategy is one he hasn't ever tired of using. He questioned the authority and truthfulness of God's word, and at the same time, of God's goodness. Genesis 3, verse 1, and of course, Genesis 3 is the key passage on the fall. The serpent said to the woman, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" Now, that was not what God had said, of course. Even Satan's question twists God's speech. This still happens so frequently. God said his image bearers could freely enjoy the riches of every tree except one. But the serpent successfully twisted Eve's eyes away from that vast gift and trained them to focus on the one thing that she couldn't have. That's what all covetousness is, including ours. So look at verse 3. Eve says, "Well, God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.'" The crafty serpent saw an opening in Eve's words. He became bold. He contradicted God directly, and then he snuck in a half-truth. Look at verses 4 and 5. The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die." There's the direct contradiction. "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Satan suggested again, without ever saying so, that God was not good, that he was withholding some kind of special pleasure from Eve, a life better than the one that God had given her. Satan tricked Eve into seeking a good thing, but seeking it in an evil way. The serpent knew his prey. It was precisely because Eve was made in the image of God that she viewed being like God as a tempting prospect. Satan, again, does not create evil desires. He can't create anything. He can only twist good things God has already created, like the desire to be like God. So in verse 6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired, to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Genesis 2 makes it clear that God had made trees for just the reasons that Eve was attracted to this one. If you look back at Genesis 2:9, the text says that God made every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. So food is good, as is delight, as is being wise like God. Eve's sin began, as all sins do, when good things get bent the wrong way. God's good creation was used against him. God's creatures tried to make themselves equal to him instead of merely being like him. One of my favorite theologians, his name is John Frame. I run his website. Godly, elderly man. He said, sin is irrational. Why would anyone turn from the beauty and joy of covenant life with God and embrace its opposite? Or why would anyone think he could succeed in opposing God's omnipotent power? But by the third chapter of the Bible, God's highest and best creation, the only part of the creation that was made in his image, has already plunged into sin. This sin that happens embarrassingly fast in Genesis will now take millennia to undo. Is there any chance anyone in here has read the book Paralandra by C.S. Lewis? Am I the only one? If I ever get to come back to this church, I won't do it until everyone has read Paralandra. That's not true. I'll come back before that. I highly recommend this book. It's actually a retelling of the Adam and Eve story in which a serpent figure, it gets a little literarily complicated, but is trying to tempt an Eve figure on the planet Venus. Their conversations last forever and ever as Satan keeps trying different angles of attack to get Eve to sin, to disobey the commands of her creator. And I read that book. It's one of my very favorite books ever. And I come back to the Bible, and our actual mother, Eve, didn't last more than two sentences before she's sinning. It's a little embarrassing. And yet, this epic, world-shattering fall happens right in the beginning of the very Bible of the Bible story. It's so stupid. Like all of our sins, the pleasure was so minuscule compared to the subsequent pain. Adam and Eve ate, but as a result, they felt empty rather than full. The serpent, of course, had wrapped the truth around a lie. Yes, God knew that when Adam and Eve ate from the tree, their eyes would be opened. But what they got when that forbidden juice hit their tongues was not a better life. What they experienced was something that only humans can experience, and only because of sin, the shame of nakedness. Look at verse 7 in chapter 3. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. Some Canadian translations translate fig leaves as maple leaves. That's actually not accurate. As we were driving down the highway, I won't say which child did this, but we saw a McDonald's sign, and one of my children said, well, I guess he's not here, so I can say. The youngest one said, oh, wow, look, a maple leaf was blown against the sign. He saw that little maple leaf in the middle of the McDonald's sign and thought it was an actual leaf that had the wind had blown up there right in the center. I said, no, that's actually the Canadian maple leaf. That was not in my planned notes. Don't write that down, okay? It's a little awkward to say so. Let's talk about nakedness, but you know this is true. To go without clothes around other people takes real trust. You trust a doctor when absolutely necessary, but only for a few minutes, with other devices to keep you as modest as possible. You will likely one day, if you're not already married, trust a spouse, because in marriage, two become one. And even in both of those trusting situations, you're never unaware that you're exposed. You know, nobody ever forgets to put on clothes. going out for the day. And, you know, nobody ever is running out to the car and reaches for his wallet and goes, oh, I forgot my pants. Doesn't happen. That's why the fifth and sixth graders came, just for that. Oh, the relationship Adam and Eve shared with each other and with their creator must have been deeply rich and trusting if Adam and Eve never even realized they were without clothes. And now with one act of defiance, the trust is shattered. The beautiful life they were given is gone. Today, even the wickedest people on earth have not forgotten that they're naked. That barrier between humans and God, created by sin, remains. From Genesis 3 onward, the Bible speaks of all people, all Adam's race, as being dead in trespasses and sins, and by nature, children of wrath. That is the sense in which Adam and Eve died on that dark day when man fell. Death is the loss of life. Have you ever wondered, why does it say in Genesis, the very day you eat of it, you will surely die, but they don't? Here's a little Bible reading principle. If you ever come across something that seems like an obvious contradiction, don't assume that you are smarter than the Bible writers, who also would have known, yes, Adam and Eve did not die physically. That must have meant something different. Indeed, since man is complex in his being, a spirit being and a physical being, the judgment of death is complex as well. Adam's inner man died immediately when he sinned. He was separated from God, the only source of spiritual life, but his outer man did not die until he was 930. Jesus restores both kinds of life, and we'll get to that in the final session. He restores spiritual and physical life. He said, whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. But just as Adam's physical death did not occur until long after his spiritual death, perfect physical life will be restored to believers long after we get spiritual life. Until then, we face the effects of the fall in our always dying bodies. We're still talking about those effects of the fall, the effects of the fall on everyone. Think of how Adam's fall flipped the world upside down. He was supposed to submit to God, just as his wife was given as a helper to him, and as animals submitted to both of them. Instead, an animal led Eve, who led Adam, who blamed God. When Adam and Eve heard God coming, they did something that image bearers had never done before. They hid. When God found them, Adam explained, I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. And God replied, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? And look at verses 10 through 12 there in Genesis 3. Watch how quickly Adam, serpent-like, learns to twist the truth. Look at verse 12. The man said, the woman you gave to be with me, she gave me of the fruit of the tree, and I ate. We're starting to see that the fall has effects, like a lie that requires a cover-up lie. Or like pollution that permeates an entire reservoir. Sin spreads immediately through God's best creation. Adam's reasoning has been damaged. It is supremely irrational to make excuses to a God who sees everything and then to blame him for the trouble that you caused. The powers of logic that God gave only to image bearers have been damaged. The Apostle Paul explains that after the fall of Adam, people are naturally darkened in their understanding. Understanding, ignorance. These are words that focus on a person's mind or his thinking. Sin has twisted mankind's reasoning powers, but it hasn't removed them. Actually, Adam uses exquisite logic in the three statements that he makes to God. All three are true, and yet they add up to a big lie. He's not just listing off what happened. He's giving three reasons for the fall. First, there's you, God. You gave me this woman. Second, there's her. She gave me this fruit. Then last and certainly least, there's me. I ate. He admits to his role in the sin only after he condemns the only other people available, basically, his maker and his mate. The two beings Adam is supposed to love most, God and his wife. He throws under the bus. So it isn't just his mind that's damaged. After Paul describes how Adam's heirs are all naturally darkened in their understanding, he says, and I talked about this last night, their darkness is due to their hardness of heart. Adam, deep in his heart, strayed from his purpose of loving God and neighbor, and he subsequently twisted his picture of reality to fit his wayward loves. Remember I said that. It's a head-heart system that makes up a worldview. It's not just your ideas. Your ideas are built on something deeper. Just as in God, they're built on your loves. This pattern still exists today. What you love drives what you think. I find that to be such a powerful thing, both in diagnosing my own wrong thoughts and actions, I have to look for the wrong loves that are driving me, and in seeing where others have gone astray, even very smart people, especially very smart people, when they push back against a Christian worldview, I'm looking for their loves. What are they loving? They're not loving God and neighbor. The fall of man, mind and heart and spirit and body, is why people today go so wrong. Hitler wrong. And you and me wrong. Just as Adam hid from God's sight, we hide God from our sight. People suppress their knowledge of God. Romans 1 says that he gave them this knowledge, and yet they've exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. Our thinking minds and our worshiping hearts get twisted in wrong directions. So that Paul can say, quoting an Old Testament prophet I was just reading the other day, no one does good, not even one, Romans 3. We do irrational, self-harming things, Romans 3:11. No one seeks for God. These are the effects of the fall on everyone. How horrendous. In his book about original sin, which is the Christian doctrine of how the fall affects everyone, one of my favorite writers, Alan Jacobs, a Christian writer, he says that whatever the situation might have been for Adam and Eve, for us, the devil on our shoulder is only truly dangerous because of the devil that's already inside us. What he means is, and he gives this illustration, he says, have you ever seen in a cartoon an angel on somebody's shoulder over here and a devil on their shoulder over here? I'm glad people are nodding. You know, every once in a while I'm thinking, are Canadians similar enough to U.S. folks that you've seen cartoons also? You know, I presume so. Jacobs points out that these cartoon characters are almost always pictured as miniature versions of that same character. You know what I'm talking about? Have you seen this? There's good in every person because God's image is still resident in every person. From the prostitute to the mob boss to the prime minister to the Christian. There is good in every person. But evil has touched every aspect of every man, woman, and child. God destroyed the world in Noah's day when he saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Even after he cleanses the earth with the flood, he says in Genesis 8, the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. The fall has had massively earth-shattering ramifications for God's image bearers, and nothing has changed. The Bible teaches that the effects of the fall are pervasive. It's common for Christians to say, don't follow your feelings. You need to follow the Bible. And I get what they're going for. But when they talk longer, they talk as if you need to reason with your feelings, as if your reason is unfallen. No, your reason is just as fallen as your feelings are. Both of them need to be submitted to God, twisted back into the right shape. Your feelings and your will and your thinking. The Bible does not teach that all people are as bad as they could possibly be. Instead, it says, those who are in the flesh cannot please God. That's Romans 8. And by in the flesh, Paul means there people who don't have spiritual life from God. Some non-Christians are incredibly generous. The image of God is strong in them by God's common grace. Some are Hitlers. But the same spiritual death and ultimate rebellion runs through each group. No amount of good deeds can overturn the fact that deep in our hearts, we're born at war with God. The old King James says, at enmity with him and not at peace with him. Even if we do good, We refuse to do it for the only right reason there is, love for the loveliest being in the universe. That's the way we're born, as heirs of Adam. Do you know Frodo Baggins? As he stands over the fires of Mount Doom, at the climax of the Lord of the Rings, close your ears if you haven't read it and you don't want, you know, spoilers, spoiler alert here. He's reached the end of his quest to destroy the evil ring. Frodo does the unthinkable. Instead of throwing the ring into the fire, which he just sacrificed how many months of his life going through tons of dangers, having to fight a massive spider in order to get there, instead of throwing it in the fire, he puts it on and vanishes. But it's not clear whose decision it was, Frodo's or the ring's. Even Frodo avoids saying that it was his choice. He says only, "I do not choose now to do what I came to do. The ring is mine." In both the book and the movie, Frodo speaks with a voice that's not quite his own, but yet is his own. Tolkien, the author, doesn't tell us exactly what's going on inside this hobbit, but he does provide a picture of the power of sin that every Christian can recognize. Frodo's uncle Bilbo felt that power too. If you've never read a Lord of the Rings and these names are really strange to you, I'm really sorry. When Gandalf the wizard asks Bilbo about the ring, Bilbo snaps, "It's mine, I tell you, my own, my precious, yes, my precious." And Gandalf says, "That ring has far too much hold on you. Let it go, and then you can go yourself and be free." Bilbo says, "I'll do as I choose and go as I please." But Bilbo's choosing and his pleasing are not free. While he still has that ring, Bilbo is in bondage, unaware that true freedom is not the liberty to do what you want, but the liberty to want what you should. Tolkien brilliantly pictures the tendency of sin to promise freedom. That ring will make you invisible and powerful. But instead it delivers slavery. Gollum is the character who is enslaved to the ring, and it turns him from something like a human into something like an animal. That is the legacy of Adam's fall, the enslavement of mankind. Jesus said, "Everyone who practices sin is a slave of sin." And no one in this sin-cursed world is exempt. You and I, we were all born in slavery. Thank God that God sent a second Adam, a sinless one, to set the captives free. But if you don't recognize yourself in Bilbo, you are probably still a captive to the effects of the fall on everyone. Let's turn briefly now to the effects of the fall on everything. A few years back, there was a beautiful panda mother whose name was Loon Loon. That's a Chinese name, of course. And she gave birth to cuddly twin boys, Mei Loon and Mei Huan, at the Atlanta Zoo down in Georgia. And the whole world said a collective, "Aw, they're so cute." These two tiny, wiggly pink pandas were presented to the public, and mommy and the little ones, you know, they looked like their tryouts for the cutest greeting card competition. There was even a live 24-hour-a-day panda cam that allowed panda enthusiasts from around the world to monitor the adorableness in real time. I can't say I am a, you know, adorable panda enthusiast, but there must be many of them out there. However, Loon Loon's keepers at the zoo knew that for public relations purposes, they needed to handle this situation carefully. They prepared to rotate the babies, giving only one at a time to Loon Loon. Her public image and that of all pandas was at stake. That's because panda mothers typically keep twins alive only long enough to know if their chosen baby is healthy, then they let the other baby die. If Loon Loon did that with either Mei Loon or Mei Huan, it would be bad for zoo business, to say the least. You know, small children would be confused. "Mommy, why doesn't she feed that one?" Hallmark cards would not come calling anymore. But if Loon Loon had let one baby panda die, it would not have been unique, not among pandas and not among human mothers. Mother guinea hens walk so fast that they purposefully leave some of their little cute chicks behind, weeding out the weak. Great black eagle moms regularly feed only one eaglet. The conflict between creation and evolution may seem like it's all about radiometric dating, fossils, starlight and time, shale layers, reason versus faith, DNA analysis. It might seem like an epic war of science versus religion. But it's actually about dead panda babies. The real heart of the creation-evolution debate is a question. Is the world the way it's supposed to be? In other words, is the present state of the cosmos normal or abnormal? Are pandas supposed to let their babies die? Are humans? About 20% of pregnant women had their unborn babies killed in a recent year. Are pain and death and terrible evil supposed to exist in this world? The secular, materialistic, evolutionary worldview that probably most people around here assume, depending on their cultural roots probably, that worldview can't say anything is supposed to be. It just is. Material universes formed by random chance can't suppose stuff. So when Alfred Lord Tennyson famously described nature as red in tooth and claw in 1844, it was a description of evolution that both evolution's critics and its believers have adopted. You might have heard of famous atheist Richard Dawkins. He said, "I think nature red in tooth and claw sums up our modern understanding of natural selection admirably." Evolutionists think that that phrase, the violence and death inherent in nature, accurately describes the way things just are. Species kill each other off in the never-ending struggle toward survival of the fittest. The secrets of evolution are time and death, said Carl Sagan. Time for the slow accumulations of favorable mutations and death to make room for new species. But creationists, us Christians, we use that red and tooth and claw phrase as a criticism because we're saying death is abnormal. This is not the way things are supposed to be. Death was not in God's very good creation. Paul says clearly, sin came into the world through one man and death through sin. If there had been no sin, there would be no death. And Paul says, one man is responsible. That man, of course, was Adam. And yet his sin did not affect just himself. I don't follow Canadian politics incredibly closely. I follow it a little more than I used to because I'm up close to the border. And during COVID time especially, you know, Canadian politics was making world news when the truckers had that blockade or protest. And I'm not going to take political sides here, but what I don't really understand is quite how the parliament works. But I know the U.S. Congress is divided into two houses, the Senate and the House of Representatives. And you ask, representatives of what? They represent the voters who put them into office in whatever district they hail from. So if the congressman from my district votes no on a particular bill, it's as if I did. I voted no. But there are definitely people in my district, maybe me, who would have voted yes if we could have been there. And there were children and others in our district who are unable to vote, but who are nonetheless affected by political decisions in faraway Washington, D.C. There are, in fact, animals and rivers and trees that are affected by votes off far away from them that they know nothing about. Not everyone can vote on every bill, so that's the way the American governmental system works, and I gather it's similar in Canada. And it's basically the way God's system works, too. God appointed one representative for the human race, Adam. He is our federal head, theologians call him. And when that representative voted against God in the Garden of Eden, God treated that vote as if we all voted. Adam voted for the de-godding of God, and that audacious act was recorded on the books as the vote for all humanity. But because Adam was not just a representative, he was also the ruler of creation. His sin ended up being a terrible distortion of the creation mandate. It's like he jumped into a hole with all of creation tied to his waist by a rope, including animals, rivers, and trees. When God's appointed ruler fell into sin, all of creation was plunged into the same pit. Look down on Genesis 3 again. Look at the kinds of things that God says will happen. Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head and you shall bruise him on the heel. We'll talk about that a little bit more, Lord willing, in the next session. Then God turns to Eve. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you will bring forth children. Yet your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now one of Eve's most important roles, bringing new image bearers into the earth to fill it, will involve multiplied pain. But it's when God turns to Adam that sin's cosmic effects become most clear. Look at verses 17 to 19. God says to Adam, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree, Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. God was to rule over man, but man rebelled against God. Man was to rule over the ground, but now it will rebel against him. Work is not itself a punishment. Remember this, because God gave work as a good gift to Adam before the fall. But the very blessings of the creation mandate, subdue the earth, have dominion, fill the earth, multiply, these will now be frustrating. Pregnancy and birth are going to be painful. Thorns and thistles are going to constantly fight against your labors. The ground will still be fruitful, but it's also going to be cursed, good but fallen. And at the end of years, centuries of often frustrating work, Adam was going to return to as ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Work is still cursed today. The creation is still cursed today. Listen to what Romans 8 says. The creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. It says, the creation was subjected to futility in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption. If you know Romans 8, you know that it says, the whole creation has been groaning. Creation is stuck in the same hole Adam got us into. The effects of the fall affect everyone and everything. Now, is this fair? I'm going to close with this. Is it fair that we face so many perverse effects from Adam's long ago sin? That same theologian I quoted earlier, John Frame, whose writings I highly recommend. I really love the way, the simple sentences that he uses. It just makes it much easier to read. I enjoy it. He gives several responses. First, we all sin just like Adam did. There are no innocent human beings. If you want to say that this is not fair, which of you can cast the first stone? Second, he says, if you'd been in the garden, are you certain you would have done better than Adam did? Third, humans are always tied to one another. There's no such thing as a true loner. Parents, for example, don't just pass on eye shape and hair color to their kids. They pass on moral character, the way they raise their kids. Fourth, if treating Adam as our representative is unfair, so is treating Christ as our new representative, which we'll talk about in the final session. At some point, we just have to trust God. Trust that God is good, even if he doesn't seem to exhaustively prove it to us. And yet, what other proof is needed besides Christ's self-sacrificial death for us? Adam jumped into a pit with a rope tied to him, and he pulled us all in. The fall affects everyone and everything. You can look at everything in the world and say, ultimately, it was created good, but it has been touched by the fall. That doesn't mean it's as bad as it could be. But it does mean that the fall affects it somehow. And you can finally look at that thing, whatever it is, and talk about it in terms that we'll use in the final session. This is something that Christ is going to redeem, to pull back under his rule. We read 1 Corinthians 15 earlier today. He's going to have all things put under his feet. That rope tying us to Adam and tying creation to him when he jumped in that pit, that was a strong rope. But the rope tying believers to Christ is stronger than the one tying us to Adam. And if you want to hear about Christ's redemption of this fallen world, eat some subs and stick around.